Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Please continue eating. I'd love to be able to serve you lunch every day, but you are going to have to let us sing for our lunch up here for a little while. Thank you for joining us for what is the second of our semi-regular federal forum series, sponsored by the Office of Federal Relations and the Division of Public Affairs. As I said, this is the second one. Earlier this year, we're on a pretty roll of prescience, because earlier this summer, we had a federal forum on the student loan situation, which actually had been in the planning stages for a long time and ended up being was scheduled to occur just at the moment when student loans were on the top of mind, the front page of every newspaper and website around regarding the various scandals. Today we're not quite as prescient, hopefully, but we do have a very hot topic, a very interesting topic, obviously, as witnessed by the sellout crowd here today. We actually had to turn people away because there was such interest in this. An issue that is of tremendous, intense, and very lucrative and very expensive interest to this university, the whole issue of research compliance and regulation, and what is happening in Washington and what Vanderbilt is doing about it, and how the two intersect. On the way over here, I was thinking of trying to think of a clever way to describe this. Best I could come up with, unfortunately, is that today we're going to talk about research from bench, the lab bench that we all know and love, to bench. The bench that we don't want to appear in front of should something go wrong. And to do that today, we have four of the most knowledgeable people, not just on the Vanderbilt campus, but I would argue in the country, on research, compliance, legal, and political issues around those areas. And we're going to hear from them momentarily. But one thing to keep in mind, I know we're all very focused on our individual projects, on our individual programs or group programs or labs or departments, but think about this. Last year we had about $550 million in federal research funding awards, the vast majority of that from the federal government in some form or another. That's not philanthropy. That's not free money. So when we think about Vanderbilt as a private institution and as an independent institution, we also have to remember that a significant, if not the significant, source of the funds and of the resources that allow us to do that kind of discovery comes from the federal government. And as much as we would like to, and as much as we advocate for this to be a partnership between the government and the private sector and the universities in the form of peer-reviewed scholarship, it is, at the end of the day, federal funds. And there is an intense and growing interest in accountability, an intense and growing interest in responsibility, and an intense and growing interest in on the part of politicians and policymakers in finding the outrages and finding the excesses and finding the abuses in order to make a point. So Vanderbilt has, because of our culture and because of all the work that you all do, has been very responsible in dealing with these issues, and it's our goal as an institution to continue to be responsible and to continue to be responsive to both the changes in the regulatory and policy environment, but also to be sensitive to the changes and the issues that are on the mind of political leaders. And that brings us to today. That brings us to our federal forum, federal research compliance. Why are they doing this to us? And to answer those questions, not only about why they're doing it, why they are doing this to us, but what we are doing in response and how the two will connect, I'm going to introduce right now the four our four speakers and the order in which they will speak. And then our format today will be opening remarks from each of these folks, who all of you know, I'm sure. And then we will open it up for questions and discussions and commentary. And our goal, as always, is to be prompt and to be out of here by 1:30. And I'll preface this. I'll preface the questions. I'll remind that preface the discussion by reminding everybody to be thinking about your questions and thinking about these issues as they go along. And also, in the interest of both time and the broad scope, if we could keep questions and comments to a general nature as opposed to my lab is doing this particular thing and am I going to be okay? John will be happy to have office hours afterwards to let you know if you should be getting measured for an orange jumpsuit.
I make house calls too.
Yeah, John depends on his house calls. So, with that, in the order in which they will be speaking, Jeff Vincent, many of you know, is Assistant Vice Chancellor for Federal Relations and the Executive Director of our Washington office, has been involved in a number of activities with our higher education and research associations and coalitions in Washington on this issue, has actually spent a lot of time up on the Hill talking to members of Congress and their staffs about both Vanderbilt research issues in particular, but also more broadly, the environment in which we operate, the challenges that we face, and the opportunities that we're trying to seize in partnership and collaboration with the government. Jeff will be followed by Dennis Hall, who is Associate Provost for Research and Graduate Education and also the Dean of the Graduate School, and an eminent scholar and physicist himself, as many of you know, and somebody who has whose experience spans not only the academic world, the university world, but also the corporate sector as well. Dennis will be followed by Jerry Fife, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Research Finance, who oversees the contract and grant accounting and all of the important and essential foundation, the baseline, that the operational activities, and does as much as anybody can to keep us out of jail. Jerry also, I should add, was just honored last week with a Lifetime Achievement Award from NSURA, the National Council for University Research Administrators. So when we talk about having the best of the best, Jerry is living proof. And then a man known to many, if not all of us, John Callison, is Senior Deputy General Counsel and has been one of our chief legal guides, Sherpas, and consciences for certainly as long as I've been here and a lot longer before that, and is, as we all know, the person whose number is on your speed dial. If you ever get in trouble, John's number is right at the top. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us. I'm going to let Jeff kick it off here.
Okay, well, thanks, Mike, very much, and thank you all for coming today. I thought just a few moments ago maybe we should have added some chicken wire up here in case you all start throwing beer bottles at me or something, but it's too late. I've represented Vanderbilt in D.C. for a little more than a decade, and in the last couple of years, I guess, I've noticed a real swing in emphasis in terms of what's going on in D.C. that's of greatest interest to research universities and to Vanderbilt specifically. And those are the things that I use and Mike uses to set priorities for our office in Washington. I think while there's always been a wide range of important federal issues, the top dog has almost been appropriations, especially among the agencies that sponsor extramural research in the health sciences, physical sciences, and engineering. That's still vitally important, of course, but the market shares have increased for several other areas, including tax policy, intellectual property, student aid, and the current push, both overarching and ubiquitous, I think, for the populist goals of access, affordability, and accountability in higher education. What all these issues share is that they all represent greater federal involvement in what we've historically viewed as our business. I make it a practice to visit campus at least once a month, and we also have a steady stream of faculty and administrators who visit our office in D.C. Lately, the single issue about which I've been hearing more complaints and concern than any other is the burden of complying with federal regulations. These regulations cut across almost everything we do on campus, but they are keenly felt by those of us in the research enterprise, hence today's forum on federal research compliance. The list of federal regulations affecting university research would fill scores or probably hundreds of PowerPoint slides, but here's a relatively short list of some that are hot enough to have made it onto the radar screen in my office. Some of you no doubt would have additional nominees. Now, I'm not going to go through all these in detail right now. It's not the purpose here today, and there are other panelists here who are much more savvy about these than I am. I would note that some of these, particularly the three at the bottom, are really quite recent. There's the reinstated requirement for cost sharing of NSF MRI awards. There's the new requirement to include a plan for, quote, responsible conduct of research, unquote, in NSF grant proposals. And of course, especially newsworthy in the last few days, a cap on indirect costs for DOD 6.1 research. At least one leading national policymaker recognizes what's been going on in this arena and appreciates the downsides of overregulation. Standing in front of stacks of boxes filled with higher education regulations, this person held forth on this issue in a major speech last May. I'll show you, but also read just a few quotes from that speech. This person says, there's plenty of evidence that America's secret weapon in our system of colleges and universities, it is America's secret weapon in our colleges and universities. More Americans go to college than any other country. Most of the best universities of the world are in our country. Deregulating higher education and preserving the autonomy of its institutions, not more Washington, D.C. regulation, is the key to preserving the quality of the secret weapon in our effort to keep our high standard of living. This stack of regulations I have here represents the 7,000, yes, 7,000 regulations that each one of the 6,000 colleges and universities who accept federal aid must deal with. First, I wanted to say the president of Stanford has estimated it costs 7 cents of every tuition dollar just to deal with federal regs and loans. Universities have compliance officers and divisions to keep track of regulations for almost every cabinet agency in Washington. With these multiple layers of regulation, higher education needs less, not more regulation from Washington, D.C. In fact, I believe the greatest threat to excellence of higher education is overregulation, not underfunding. So who knows who said that? No guesses. Okay. That was from our very own Senator Lamar Alexander, who said all that on the floor of the U.S. Senate back in May. He was speaking not only as a respected member of Congress and the top-ranking Republican on the Education Subcommittee, but also from his perspective as a former cabinet member and a governor, and especially as a former university president. Unfortunately, none of the other 534 members of Congress share this particular set of life experiences, nor do any of the current leaders of the executive branch, and it shows. In my opinion, we're seeing an unprecedented escalation of federal involvement in the way we do our business, and this is reflected in the surge of research regulations. So how did we get here? I have my own opinions on this, but I also augmented my thoughts by surveying 10 of my most trusted colleagues in the so-called higher education lobby in Washington. Here's a quick tour of some of the major themes. Some believe that the hand-wringing about federal regulations is cyclical. They point to the Stanford yacht headlines that drove indirect cost concerns of the 90s and calls for more accountability on human subject research that follow major and usually unfortunate news stories in that arena. We can only hope that it's cyclical and that we're at another peak in the cycle. I personally think we're seeing a continuing upward trajectory in federal involvement with occasional peaks and valleys along the way. We're also increasingly expanding our research into new frontiers of science and technology. Think about areas like nanotechnology or synthetic genomics, and that drives new opportunities for oversight. Besides, once put into place, regulations rarely disappear or sunset. They may change, but as one person noted, nothing ever really goes away. It is the way of the world, especially in Washington, that nothing comes for free, and Mike alluded to this. Federal dollars, whether they are for research or student aid, always come with strings attached. As the dollars grow, and as Mike said, they have, so do the regulatory requirements. Security concerns in the post-9/11 world have surely generated many of the newer regulatory requirements. Think about such areas as laboratory access, background checks, biohazardous materials, and export controls. And keep in mind that few senior administration officials or members of Congress will ever want to appear to be against anything intended to strengthen national security. These days, Congress is facing constraints on domestic spending. And as one of my colleagues said, when there's no money, all that's left for Congress is to regulate. After all, public figures have to be seen as doing something. If that's not a scary thought, it should be. A couple of my Republican colleagues pointed out that the swing of congressional control to the Democrats, who are often thought of as being friends of higher education, has not diminished the thirst for regulations and may even have fueled it. Quote, Democrats tend to be more policy and regulatory focused, where Republicans tend to spend more time on taxes and less on regulation, one of them suggested. We've all heard the old saw that making legislation is like making sausage. The result might be great, but you surely don't want to watch the process. That applies equally or even more so when the legislation requires the departments and agencies to promulgate new regulations. Oftentimes, these policies and regulatory requirements are developed behind closed doors and in the dead of night, and by congressional staff who don't have the time, resources, or experience to fully understand the issues and develop thoughtful responses. The situation is ripe for many unintended consequences. Other comments from my colleagues included, we regulate in response to scandals, and we regulate in response to political correctness. I believe that Congress acts in response to even broader forces and perceptions, and like it or not, fair or not, there's a widely held perception that, as one panelist said at last month's COBRA meeting in Washington, universities are seen as fat, rich, and happy. I would add the top-tier universities are widely regarded as smug, liberal, and elitist. In addition, we are increasingly seen as having a business orientation, concerned more with the bottom line and our relationships with corporate partners and big donors than about our academic mission. Add to that the broad public concern about the quote-unquote tuition crisis, the target of late-night talk show hosts, presidential candidates, investment counselors, bloggers, and public policy pundits, and it's not a pretty picture. This increasingly negative perception of higher education affects every one of our issues in Washington and creates an environment where Congress and the administration feel they are unrestrained in going after us. Here's how AAU President Bob Birdall summed up the environment in a letter to AAU presidents and chancellors just 2 weeks ago. You can read this, growing evidence that our federal policymakers lack confidence in our institution's ability to conduct our business properly and fulfill our various missions. This lack of confidence has been expressed in several ways, including proposals to set minimum payout rates for university endowments, create new conflict of interest rules, expand the federal role in accreditation, institute federal tuition price controls, and cap indirect costs on defense basic research. So that's a quick look at the Washington angle on this. I'm going to turn it over to Dennis and his matching herringbone jacket here.
Well, after hearing that, I was led to think that we missed somebody on the panel. We need a therapist. Well, I guess I should say that this afternoon's event actually was hatched in my office when Jeff Vincent, who was so pleased with the way the last federal forum worked out, came to me and said, we ought to do this again. What would be a good topic? And since I'm thinking of changing my job title to Associate Provost for Compliance, I sort of knew what the topic ought to be, because I think there's a lot of pent-up frustration about the rules and their increasing enforcement on the part of universities. So mostly we want this to be an opportunity for Q&A, but I thought I might make three general remarks that serve as kind of a backdrop for that Q&A. One of them is that federal regulations governing research have actually been around for a very long time. What has changed is that for a time, for quite a long time, the federal government sort of applied these quite rigorously to corporations and of course, federal laboratories. But universities were kind of left out of the mix. And one downside of that is that the rules have kind of been created against the industrial setting without anybody thinking about us too much. And so more and more, we're in an era of what you might call uniform accountability, and universities are being thought of as federal contractors when they have federal funds. That's the basic backdrop. Before I got involved with research universities, my initial job was actually with an aerospace company. And just to give you a sense, so this was in the late 1970s, and just to give you a sense of how that worked, basically, most of the people who work in an aerospace company are in fact supported by federal funds. But those of us who are involved in research also wrote proposals to get more money. So what had to happen at that time is, if I wanted to write a proposal, I would go to my department manager and I would say, I want to write a proposal. What this would mean is that I would have to be taken off of the contractual support that was supporting me, and I would have to be supported by company funds, so-called new business funds, in the company I worked for. The department manager had a limited number of funds for that. And so basically, the opportunity to submit a proposal was a competitive thing. One didn't just automatically have the right to submit a proposal because you were consuming company funds in so doing. So the department manager had to be sure that what you wanted to do was along the strategic direction of the department and the company, and also had a high enough probability of being successful to justify the expenditure of the internal funds. So that was actually quite a different setting than we have in universities, where every faculty member expects to be able to submit proposals. But nevertheless, back at the end of the 1970s even, you could not be supported by federal funds when you wrote proposals. This is well known, and it is true for us as well today. You can't do that. The government hasn't looked at us very carefully about that, but they're starting to. The second point I want to mention is that while all this seems to be happening to us, you should be aware that there's a very active communication going on among universities. So this happens on a one-on-one level. My colleague, the person at Duke University, Jim Cito, who has the research portion of my job, he and I talk all the time about this stuff. So there's one-on-one conversations going on all throughout the country trying to get this straight. There are also conversations going on within organizations like AAU or through Jerry Fife with Coger. John Childress, when he goes to Encura meetings, all of these people who represent universities in one way or another are talking amongst each other, trying to figure out what the terrain actually is, trying to figure out what it is we ought to be doing. One of the downsides of the federal government not watching us very carefully for a long period of time is that universities, each one different than the other, have built up a standard set of practices that they consider normal. Now, in fact, those of you who have worked at more than one university know that normal at one university is not the same as normal at a different university, and we have hundreds and hundreds of these universities around the country. So we've got widespread practices, all of which we think of as normal, and in order to be compliant, we have to even figure out what this means. And because I don't want to use Vanderbilt, I don't want to use any examples at Vanderbilt, I'll use the University of Rochester, where I used to work. So I can tell you that as early as 1980, which is when I started working there, on the question of summer salary, that is faculty charging summer salary to federal grants, basically there was an institutional policy that no more than 2.5 months of salary could be charged unless a faculty member wrote a letter to the cognizant dean saying he or she will take no vacation that summer, because you can't charge vacation time to federal grants. So that was known in the early 80s. And at a meeting a few weeks ago, actually, Ken Galloway pointed out that this was known at the University of Arizona in 1967. So these are not new rules. Sorry about how you want to. So you might say that in 1980, the University of Rochester was kind of ahead. They understood that rule better than many other universities. However, I actually, because I had come out of industry, the first summer I was there, I asked the question, how is it that we, supported by federal grants, can write proposals during the summer? How can we do that? And I was told by the person who had my job at the University of Rochester that, oh, it's only the average that matters, and because the university pays so much during the academic year, and it all comes out in the wash. Well, in fact, auditors don't see it that way. So they were actually just wrong on that. But that's just an example. If you looked at any university, you would find they've got some stuff right and they've got some stuff wrong. When you try to fix the stuff that's wrong, there's quite a blowback on campus for the simple reason that that's normal. But because of the way this is all developed, normal isn't actually always correct. So we all have to work together to kind of sort ourselves out on the Vanderbilt campus. The third point I want to make is that there's actually quite an active collaboration going on between the central administration and the schools and the various offices on the campus. We're all actually working on this together. And I will just offer one example. On October the 19th, in a conference room in the Baker Building, there was a meeting attended by, I have the list, Camilla Benbow, Richard McCarty, me, Jerry Fife, Elizabeth Ravasara, Ken Galloway, Tim McNamara, John McDaniel, and John Callison, talking about just two aspects of effort reporting. Two aspects. So we spent something like 90 minutes or so at that meeting trying to figure out what one can do, what can't do, how one explains it to the faculty, all of that stuff. What that led to is a draft memo that the provost will send to the deans as the policy document. But that memo, after the meeting, drafts of it have been circulated to various people so we can make sure we're all on the same page as we roll this out. So the bottom line is that when you see us generating policies, what you should know is an awful lot of spade work is happening in advance of that so that we all come to a common understanding of what the rules are and what we're actually allowed to do. I'm tempted to say, and most of it is Tim's fault. He's just sitting there waiting. I felt I had to deliver. So anyway, know that we're all working on this together. And in fact, we're trying to be minimally intrusive in the lives of our faculty and staff, but at the same time to satisfy the requirements of the federal government so that we get as few visits as possible from auditors and people who enforce what auditors find. John Callison will talk more about that later. Thank you.
as Michael said, I kind of represent more the operational side of the house, and so I thought it might be good to give you a, just kind of a bird's eye view of what the landscape looks like in terms of the audit environment. And maybe I should have put this slide out front as why is compliance activities increasing. But we'll talk a little bit about some of the other areas of compliance as well. But just kind of to review, why are we getting more audits right now? Why are we getting more compliance activities? Well, in 1998 to 2004, as you all know, the NIH budget doubled. During that same period of time, fines and disallowances for sponsored research increased from $239 million to $1.9 billion. So you can see there's a payoff. There's a payoff to these folks going out and auditing. I mean, bottom line. And if you look, kind of take it down to Vanderbilt's level, this is where our sponsored program expenditures grew during that same period of time, from 166 to 360 million. And we're just getting more scrutiny as a result of all this. John will tell you a little bit more about how they fund some of these audits, most likely, and how that gets funded. But the truth of the matter is, more money, more audits. Each of the agencies have an Office of Inspector General, which that's an independent group of people that don't really report to the agency. Like for the National Science Foundation, they report to the National Science Board, not to the director of NSF. And they're kind of like our internal audit department, if you will. And they go out, and if you remember, I think it was Ronald Reagan who said that he wanted them to be like junkyard dogs. And so they're supposed to go out and find stuff. That's their goal in life. And we've got, I'll just talk about two of them today, the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Well, the National Institutes of Health will never be at the top of their radar screening because they've got a bigger target than universities. They've got Medicare, and that's always going to be a huge area for them to audit, and they'll tell you that. But they have spent a little more time in universities lately, and they publish an audit plan every year to Congress, and I just kind of excerpted theirs. NSS just came out, but NIH had came out a little earlier. They're looking at conflict of interest. That's going to be probably the primary focus of NIH for a number of years now. And if you follow this, they had a huge initiative within the organization for intramural research, and now they're taking that extramural at this moment. So we'll see a lot more activity in the coming years on the conflict of interest. They're also looking at data safety monitoring boards, and there's a lot of folks in this room who could tell you a lot more about that than me. But these are the boards that govern certain parts of clinical trials and how you monitor, and you could tell us all about it probably. But that's one of the things they're going to be looking at. And then on the cost side, there are two areas that they're looking at, and direct charging of clerical and administrative salaries. And for those who have spent a little time with me, you'll know that's one of the areas I've been focusing on over the last year and a half. And the reason is because they're focusing on it. And we know that's something that's going to come up. It comes up in a number of different audits. And the government changed their rules in the 1990s, whereby they said, you can't charge these costs any longer to grants and contracts except under certain exceptional circumstances. So they're just going out and checking to make sure we're abiding by those now. And then they stuck this one in there this year, university compliance with A21 cost principles. And for those of you, I think Dennis mentioned my involvement with COGR. I serve as the chair of one of the committees for COGR, who represents the 175 largest research universities in the country. And we spend time with the Office of Inspector General in our meetings. And one of the things they told us in the last time I met with them was they just put this in here as a placeholder. In case something goes wrong, they've got something in there. So, you know, they're ready. These folks are ready. Great. Okay. The National Science Foundation, and let me contrast that to the National Institutes of Health. Extramural research is the largest component of the National Science Foundation budget. So the Office of Inspector General naturally focuses on universities more. Now, add to that over the past couple of years, the current Inspector General doesn't trust the annual audit that universities have to undergo, which is called A133. We have KPMG come in and audit us. That office, that office doesn't trust these audits, doesn't think it does a good job, doesn't think the National Science Foundation programs are being audited well enough. So she's really come out on a tear, and she's gone out and started 25 to 30 university audits of labor effort. Guess who got one of those? We did. Vanderbilt did. We've just undergone that. We actually had a small minority firm that came out and was hired by NSF to audit us. We're in the process of negotiating that report now. We had, we'll mention that a little bit more in a minute, but we had 8 findings in that report, 4 of which had nothing to do with effort, and 4 of which are effort-related but pretty minor. There, I think we'll end up with something that looks altogether different than the initial draft. Because while we try to work through and come to an agreement with them, Michelle, who's in my office, just went crazy and told them they were all full of it. She'll get me later. Actually, she did a good job of defending the audit, and I think we'll probably see an entirely different report in the end. They also are going through these desk reviews. We had one of these too at Vanderbilt. And what these desk reviews are is they picked a program, in our case it was the Engineering Research Center project, and then they start asking questions. Well, interestingly enough, the desk review asked 0 questions about the transactions on the Engineering Research Center. It was all a repeat of the A133 audit internal control kind of question. And we thought we came out of it with glowing, you know, marks, and we never hear any more about it. And guess what? 1 year later, they came back and had 4 different questions for us. And again, we created a book of information and indicated that we didn't agree with their findings. So we'll have to wait and see how that turns out. NSF is also going out to universities. I know of 3 universities in the country they've gone to, and they asked for every audit report, internal audit report, that relates to an NSF grant over the past 5 years. And there's a number of universities going through that right now. They come out and do some site visits, and so that's another audit initiative of the National Science Foundation. The final one is a total business system review, and that's a program where you have an extremely large program like a federal lab in your university. Some of the universities in the country have those. They'll be looking at those kinds of reviews, and they come out and they do an extensive review. And actually, I had an opportunity to comment on that particular audit program. So, let's take it down a notch and look at what happened at Vanderbilt. I told you kind of just what 2 agencies look like. Over the past 2 years, we've had 2 investigations at Vanderbilt, one of which is finalized with the Department of Justice. John may or may not want to comment about that. We've got one underway right now with the National Science Foundation. Both of these were people at the university picked up the phone and called the hotline at the agency and reported what they thought was wrongdoing. And the second one, we're still working on that and finalizing that. Both of these will result in paybacks. The first one, John can tell you a little bit more about what the size of that payback was. I think that's probably public now. But I can tell you whatever the settlement is minor compared to what all of the legal fees and everything else that goes into settling one of these things. The labor effort audit, I pretty much indicated what we're at, where we're at on that. We had the desk review, as I mentioned. We've had 12 contract closeout audits. We have a fairly significant amount of Department of Defense work at Vanderbilt. And as a result of that, when those contracts close out, they're coming out now and looking at those again. They didn't do that for a period of time, but that's kind of reinitiated. And we're seeing certain trends in these, just for way of information, and Dennis mentioned some of these areas. Things like cost transfers, you know, when you transfer a cost from one grant to another, a big red flag goes up to an auditor. So that's one of the areas that they're looking at. And we've tried to remind people that's an important area. Direct charging, which we mentioned again. Lack of documentation. This is something we found in the investigations as well. People aren't writing down how that benefited the grant or even the business purpose, which has a separate IRS implication. So that's something that we're trying to remind people that that's important to put that documentation down. And then when graduate students don't get paid off grants, but they travel on a grant, we've got to establish a linkage in our documentation there, because that's an area where we've really had problems. With that lack of documentation there, it just seems to cause problems in getting those costs allowed, regardless of the fact that it may be legitimate and that there may be good reason for that. It's a lot less acceptable to an auditor when you tell them rather than when you have it written down to begin with. So it's that's kind of how the landscape lays out, both on a national level and at the university. And I'm going to let, we've told you a little bit about all the stuff, and John's going to tell you now what happens if you don't follow Andy. Oh, and I have one of the things we've done, we've got a couple different things we're doing. We're trying to have some meetings with outreach efforts, and we're also trying to create some documentation for people. And I'll leave these on the back. This is just a little pocket compliance guide that talks about some of the different areas and who you contact.
It's very unfortunate. As Mike said, a lot of you all know who I am. As my children used to say, they see their friends and they say, because I had a son who went to Vanderbilt, he says, if you know my dad, that's not a very good son. Well, as Jerry and Jeff and Dennis have said, you know, they try to tell you what you need to be doing, and I'm going to tell you what happens when you don't do what you're supposed to do. And to be frank with you, there's an old saying that he who has the gold makes the rules. Well, the government has the gold, and the government has made the rules, and you have to comply with them. And unfortunately, we have a culture at many universities, and that includes Vanderbilt, of feeling that we live a very sheltered life, and we can kind of do things the way we want to do them and the way we've been doing them for many, many years. And for those of you who have relationships with the medical center, my father was a former dean of a medical school and a practicing physician, and he used to always complain about Medicare. And I'd say, why are you complaining? He says, well, they're not paying me as much as I used to. And I say, well, that's because you're not documenting all that you're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, the rules change from year to year, and the rules we're talking about today, you know, Dennis is right. They've been in place for a long time. But the government has really not been enforcing them with respect to colleges and universities. They start off enforcing them really more in the medical center areas, because they got into, if you may recall, all the Medicare billing issues that came out back in the late 1990s. And I get two examples. And I'm using these because the dollars are big, but they can apply to non-Medicare issues as well. But many years ago, University of Pennsylvania got sent a bill for $30 million from the federal government based on a 100-chart audit of their physicians' bills. They came in and looked at 100 charts, and they sent them a bill for $30 million because they said, I'm going to extrapolate that over the course of all of your physicians' billings for your institution. And Penn said, thank you. Because their choice was they could either pay the $30 million or the government would come in and audit 100% of their billings. So they said, fine, thank you. They wrote a check the next day. 2 weeks later, Thomas Jefferson Hospital, right across also in Philadelphia, got a bill for $17 million. And they said, thank you. And they wrote a check for $17 million. Well, because of those efforts, Vanderbilt went to a lot of pain and agony to start a billing compliance program in the medical center that Jim Snell is the head of, and he does a fantastic job. And we all can learn from the efforts that the medical center has done in that regard. Now, research compliance. You know, in the life of the university, as I think Mike said, there's $550 million of funding that we get for research at this institution. That is a lot of money. It is probably, other than patient care billing, it's probably the single component of what funds the university. And the government is saying, because they don't trust us, they're thinking that we don't do what we're supposed to do with respect to documenting the time and effort reporting that we do, that our staff, our technicians, and our faculty, their effort on federal grants. That's the number one thing that leaves me awake at night, every night, is worrying about what I don't know in regard to effort reporting at this institution and other institutions around the country. Now, My job is also to scare you. And I'm going to scare you because there's one federal law that is the principal federal law that the government uses to enforce compliance with government research. And that is the False Claims Act. Now, there are actually two False Claims Acts. There's a federal False Claims Act, but what a lot of people don't realize is there's also a state False Claims Act. It's very much that they operate in much the same way. So for those of you who have state of Tennessee grants or grants with the metropolitan government, like at Peabody, for example, they have False Claims Act as well, and they can be enforced just the same way the federal government does. But obviously, the most of our funding comes from the federal government. Let me just read to you excerpts of what the False Claims Act says. First of all, it says that any person, that's an individual, it can be any of you, it can be the institution itself, Vanderbilt, who knowingly presents or causes to present a false or fraudulent claim to the federal government for payment, makes a false record that can be used to make a claim to the federal government for payment, makes or delivers a receipt for reimbursement without completely knowing that the information on that receipt is true, can be fined $5,500 at a minimum or $11,000 at a maximum, plus three times the amount that you've sought in reimbursement. Now, let me give you an example. We just went through, within the last 2 years, an Office of the Inspector General audit over in the medical center of a federal grant, and I won't go into the details of it. But what I will tell you is that they were looking at effort reports, and they determined that the effort reports, namely the when the faculty member was filing their parallel action form, and they would say that 100% of my effort is being expended on this grant, when in fact, for a period of time, no part of that faculty member's effort was expended on that grant. None, because the person went on maternity leave and didn't come back. They came back, and the way they found out about it was a whistleblower. Someone from within the institution. We don't know who, and we really don't care, because that person was doing what they were supposed to do. And I have no complaints about whistleblowers, because a whistleblower is saying, my federal tax dollars are not being spent properly, and I'm going to let the government know about it. And I want the government to come in and investigate. So if you ever get one of these, don't try to find out who it is. It really doesn't make any difference who it is. What you want to do is determine whether or not you're doing things correctly or incorrectly. But in this one particular OIG investigation, they found that we ended up paying back $260,000 of the time that the individual wasn't there, plus an additional $260,000, which is the double damages. And we were lucky that it wasn't three times that amount. Plus, we paid about $30,000 in the fines, $5,511,000 in fines. Plus, we paid out over $200,000 in attorney's fees. Because one of the things we were very concerned about there, and apparently at a talk I gave a few weeks ago, may have been misunderstood. When the OIG comes in to investigate, they look principally at civil liability, the fines, the damages, the things of that nature. But if they think that the activity was premeditated and intentional, they have the right to come after you criminally. And that means Vanderbilt criminally and our researchers individually criminally. And so one of the reasons that we spent over $200,000 in attorney's fees is that we were very much concerned that there could be some criminal liability out there. As it turned out, there wasn't, and there shouldn't have been. But we didn't know that at the time. So that's one example. I mean, if you think about it, that's over $500,000 in damages, $30,000 in penalties, and $200,000 in attorney's fees, all from one research grant. And we've got lots of research grants. And as Jerry said, we have another one going on right now with NSF. I'm not going to comment on it except to say that what they're looking at are receipts and whether or not they're excesses and expenditures. You know, if you stay at a resort when you could have stayed at the Hampton Inn, they're going to look at that. Because even though we're not on per diems at Vanderbilt, the government doesn't have to accept that you can stay at a resort at $550 a night when you could have stayed at Hampton Inn for $100 a night.
and particularly in this particular case, when they let the graduate students who work on that grant stay at the Hampton Inn, or the PI stay at the Hampton Inn. So anyway, you know, the thing that I really want to kind of make a point is that there is a lot of liability out there. In fact, we have one more that we just paid about $290,000 on. That was a series of grants, and it really only involved two technicians because their time and effort was incorrect. But because the Federal False Claims Act has a 6-year statute of limitations for the most part. You can actually go back 10 years under certain situations. We had to go back all the way to 2002. Now, these were fairly, not low paid, but they're not highly compensated technicians. But when you got to go back 6 or 7 years in order to recover all that, it's a lot of time and effort on the internal audit's part to try to go back and look at those records and on part of finance. Plus, the dollars get much bigger, much quicker. So I just kind of want to leave you with this thought. There's legal exposure out there if we don't do it right. It's important to do time and effort reporting, to work with your researchers to be certain that they're doing their time and effort correct. And I know it's really hard because we have researchers who are on 4, 5, or 6 different grants, you know? And to be honest with you, if I see one, and somebody might shoot me for this, if I see one that says it's 100%, I question that to start off with, because how many people spend 100% of their time, or even 95% of their time, doing research on grants? Do they do administrative work? Do they take vacations? Do they do all those sorts of things that inroad into that percentage? Well, it can happen, but you just have to be mindful of the fact that the government is run by bean counters now. And the last thing I want to leave you with is what Jerry said, is that we are getting more and more audits. And one of the reasons we're getting more and more audits is that for every dollar that an auditor brings in from an audit, part of that is going back into a fund to fund more audits. So it's almost kind of self-prophesying. You know, the more money they raise, the more audits they get done because they have more funding to do it. And it's not the government going out and hiring auditors, employees auditors. They're using those funds to hire auditing firms to come in and audit. And so, it's in their business to get as much money as they can. I'll stop there because I know hopefully you all have a lot of questions.
Great. Just in case anybody is curious, these lunches were not paid for by any grant. They are entirely on hard money. Questions? We have about 30 minutes or so. Questions for folks here? Surely somebody has something.
Dennis raised an interesting point about federal research dollars supporting the effort of faculty. If a person is 100% on federal dollars across several different grants, are they governed by federal policies for vacation time, taking off Veterans Day, or are they governed by the university's policies for vacation time?
Well, you're not a federal employee, so you're not treated that way. The universities does not have a vacation policy for the summer. I mean, basically, in the absence of grants, faculty receive no salary. And so there is no paid vacation during the summer. So we can't charge to the government paid vacation monies when the university would not have paid it itself in the absence of the grants.
And I think, as a follow-up to your question, John mentioned it's becoming more and more difficult, and there's a lot more scrutiny about anyone who's charged 100% of grants anymore. It's just, the government's really looking at that hard if they come in.
Good. Questions? John.
I have kind of a question and a comment that I need you guys to back me up on. Representing kind of the administrative side of the room, I think sometimes there can be a misconception that if you're handed something by somebody who is a faculty or PI on a grant, and that if you have questions or concerns about what you may be asked to process or put through the business system, that you should rely on that PI or the faculty member, and they don't feel like they are empowered to have the question, the authority to question any type of those transactions. And we want you guys to help point out that certainly from the Provost's Office of Finance and Administration, you do have that power. Your deans would back you up as well, but if you could just kind of talk about that maybe, especially Jerry and John and Dennis.
Well, that's right. In fact, I spent most of my career as basically a walking around faculty member, and I can tell you when memos came out from the administration saying, you know, this is what you have to do, I didn't read that. I didn't read that. And I can assure you that even today, most faculty probably don't read that, because faculty members think of themselves as people who teach and carry out research. And administrative stuff is for somebody else. So if I were a business officer in a unit and a faculty member said to me, this is the way you should do it, I'd probably want to check on that.
I would add, you know, John and I have talked about this, and if you as a business administrator or somebody in a department are asked to sign something that you're not comfortable with and put in a position where you feel like you're forced to, you can feel free to call me. I'm more than willing to take it on. That's what they pay me for. So if you feel like you're put in a compromising position, just let me know, and I'll help you with that. The other thing I would say, and John is not only scared the crowd, he scared me in all of this. Through these investigations that we've gone through, I've learned that signing something is a big deal. You know, it's really easy to put things in front of people and get them to sign them around here sometime, but it's really hard to defend it down the road when you're asked, why did you sign this document? And you can look at some of the things that we've seen, and you go, oh, darn, I wouldn't have signed that thing, or I shouldn't have signed it if I did. You know, so I guess I would stress to you that be careful if you're signing something. You know, make sure that you feel comfortable signing it before you do so, because you may be called on to as to why you signed it. I would also say that, and I just want to put this in, and I can't speak for other offices. One of the misconceptions I've seen come up through these audits is that our office, Contract and Grant Accounting, sees everything. We don't see everything anymore. We see only certain transactions. So we don't see any of the payroll documentation going through on the front end. So if you're taking comfort that we're seeing that, we don't see it. So.
Yeah.
In 2008, when the Commons opens, move-in day is August the 16th. Faculty are not paid until the beginning of September. However, we're going to have faculty who are charging the research grants from August the 16th to the 1st of September, and we're going to have faculty who are going to be asked to be involved with students in terms of advising and other needs in that time period. What are we supposed to do the last 2 weeks of August next year with what seems to me to be a very confusing situation?
Anybody with that one?
Well, as you know, because it's not as if we haven't talked about this
before. Well, we haven't reached resolution of
it. Well, we have 8 months.
Right, so there has been some discussion about changing the definition of the summer interval so that the summer is actually from May 15th through August 14th, or whatever the appropriate 3 months is there. We simply haven't gotten to the point of working on that because there's a lot of other stuff that is actually more acute. So it's on the radar screen, and we're looking into it. I don't know if we'll get it resolved by this summer, so it does present a problem. I would say the fact that we haven't adjusted the definition of the summer doesn't actually excuse us from the effort laws, so we have to satisfy the effort regulations no matter what.
I want to go back, just no offense, Ken, I can't answer that question. I just want to kind of go back to something that Jerry was saying a minute ago, and that is, you know, if you have administrative officers, you know, who are uncomfortable about things, and I will say this, I'm now, you know, I used to sign, you know, my assistants, you know, time sheets I've never thought about it. I now look at them now to see whether or not is there any overtime being reported. Does it look, you know, generally proper? And that's what you should do every time you sign anything, because you are Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt is a corporation, and it only operates through people. And so each one of us, each employee of the university is Vanderbilt University. And when you act or you don't act, then it's Vanderbilt acting or not acting. And the knowledge that each of you all has and the people who work for you has is imputed to the chancellor of the university and to the board of the university, so that your knowledge is imputed to be Vanderbilt. And if you don't pass that knowledge on to somebody who can do something about it, then you're really responsible for the university getting into trouble. If later on we are audited and something is brought to our attention and we didn't know about it, and yet you or someone else did. So it is important that you empower the people who run your various operations in your various schools and departments. You empower them to be able to do the right thing. And if they're not comfortable doing that, they need to have somebody they can go to feel more comfortable about that. Because I can tell you, we had in one of the schools, we had an administrative officer who was doing things that shouldn't have been done. And, you know, and that particular department chair knew about some of those things. And I don't think they knew as much as the administrative officer did, but the fact of the matter is, that administrative officer isn't here any longer. The department chair is still here, still a faculty member. And so, you know, I always try to impress upon administrative officers to do the right thing, because in the end, if it's wrong, the faculty member who's tenured is still going to be here. The administrative officer who's not tenured won't be here. So again, we operate through people, and the university does, and their knowledge is imputed to the university.
Questions?
So let me just speak from the faculty's point of view. I've got two grants, and they're funding great research, but we just made this really neat discovery. It's not in the specific aims of either of the two grants, but we need to follow it up so that we can pursue our next grant. How am I supposed to do that?
Could you be a little more specific? What stands in your way?
All my time's taken.
Oh, actually, I've seen your sheet. That's right.
You're two people, actually.
Well, I'm just trying to be generic, though.
Sure.
This is the frustration of the faculty. You don't know where you're going to make discoveries.
Yeah, I mean, we have a fundamental conceptual disconnect with the federal authorities. Basically, as a university, we don't pay for time. And I'm speaking of faculty now. We don't actually pay for time. We basically pay for outcomes. When you're assigned a course to teach, nobody keeps track of how many hours that takes or whatever. Reasonableness will suggest that a teaching load can't be any more than N courses, and that will vary. But nobody is interested in the question of the clock on those kind of matters. And as an institution, we don't actually pay for the time you spend on research. We have an expectation about productivity and outcomes. And so there's nothing about the university in connection with faculty that has anything to do with time. But the federal government really focuses on the effort. And again, this is an instinct that's been finely honed by dealing with the corporate sector. And so that is overlaid onto us, and it fits improperly in all kinds of places, one of which is what you described. But basically, the federal government wants to say that there is such a thing as 100% of Jeff Shaw, and it actually allows the university to decide how it's going to do that, because they don't deal with hours per week. So a work week isn't 40 hours or 50 hours. It isn't anything like that. They allow complete freedom in determining the 100%. But once you have a way of doing it, that's it. And so if you're paid for 100%, if 100% of your time is paid for by the government, you can't do anything else.
And I think what ends up having to happen, let's say you come up with this great discovery that needs, you know, needs follow-up. And you know, you either have to make an adjustment in the amount of your effort that's charged to the two grants that you've got, so as to free up time to work on something else, on the presumption that it's going to lead to another grant sometime in the future. You know, it's kind of like grant, you know, proposal writing. You know, in a way, the university, in that scenario, the university may need to make an effort to provide funds in order to allow you to do the proposal writing or to follow up on the research, realizing that you're making an investment now in the future of future grants. Richard?
Can I follow up on Jeff's question, though?
No.
Okay. I think what Jeff was asking was, has the list of specific aims become elements of a contract? Rather, I mean, I've always thought about grants and contracts as very different.
Oh, I see.
Right. And it sounds to me like if it's within the scope of a current set of specific aims, but maybe it would be a new specific aim, that a grant allows for that. But I worry that a program officer might approve it, and an auditor would. But I'm guessing auditors never read specific aims anyway. So could you give us a little bit more assurance that the science still can triumph even within this regulation?
Actually, auditors do read specific aims anymore, unfortunately. Yes, and they make all sorts of wild assumptions that aren't correct. I mean, we've gone through one of those here on this campus. I would say in your case, though, the grant wouldn't preclude doing what you're suggesting at all. I mean, the only thing you might have to do is adjust the amount of time you're spending or charging to that particular grant during the time you're increasing your effort there. I don't think it would preclude it at all, nor would it even, I mean, you'd be the best judge of whether you needed to contact your program officer or not. Most grants, I mean, they actually encourage investigating new lines of research, in my view.
Well, right, but if the program officer validates my allocation of time and the auditor misunderstands or disagrees, who says which?
I don't think that would happen. I mean, I would think if you submitted something like an adjustment to what you might call the statement of work for the grant, and it's approved by the program officer, then that's it. I mean, that's just done.
And I don't want to mislead anyone in the room. I think there will always be honest disagreements between auditors and universities, and that's part of what I do, and I don't mind doing that. So I don't want to put us in a safe mode where we never have any questions, because then I think I would tie your hands needlessly, actually.
But I think whoever was made the right comment, that is, if you can get your program officer to sign on that this is actually kind of an extension or part of a byproduct of your research that would be considered kind of subsumed by the grant, then I don't think, even if an auditor may misread it, I think the key to it is being certain that the program officer signs off and it's clear what they're signing off to. Because the auditor is stuck with what the scope of work is that the program officer and the university have agreed to.
But I think you're right, Richard, that things have become tighter on this front. I remember when I was a beginning assistant professor, my colleagues basically told me that the idea was to write a very compelling proposal to win funding from NSF, but then once you had it, you could do what you want.
I think there are two issues in that question. One question has to do with whether Jeff do the work. And I think that's a question the program officer can help answer. But the other question is whether he could write a grant to fund the work. And the answer is you couldn't, well, funded by federal grants or contracts.
Right.
But, Tim, as you pointed out at a meeting that we had a couple weeks ago, is that, you know, if you're doing a closeout of your grant, in many ways you're starting to write the proposal from that, and you get paid to do the closeout. You just won't get paid for the grant for what basically is the next phase.
Other questions? I'm going to pose two of my own. One, Jeff, presumably these discussions and conversations are taking place at other universities and research institutions around the country. If not, then there's a far bigger problem than we can imagine. Who is, could you give us a snapshot of who is representing the science and who is representing the potential burdens that these regulations are placing on the ability of university and faculty to conduct research? Who is representing that in Washington with policymakers, and what kind of response do they get when they make those points? Mm-hmm.
I thought I was going to slip out of here, Mike. Get nailed by my own boss. I'd say that there's you can answer that on several tiers. I mean, certainly from a individual parochial standpoint, our Vanderbilt office is representing our interests in Washington, and we do so especially with our Tennessee delegation. It doesn't matter if you're a public or a private university, you always go to your state delegation first. So Christina West, who's sitting right over here, Christina, who's our Associate Director of Federal Relations, and I spend a lot of time building relationships with the Tennessee delegation and then going back in the door when we need to and with the right people in that delegation to talk about these issues and other issues that are important to Vanderbilt. And we also look at what committees those folks are on and where they might be a particular help to us in addressing certain issues that are developing. But from a broader standpoint, I really want to emphasize that we work with our national associations in Washington. I think the flagship one from our standpoint is AAU, which has a very good staff, has very capable people who understand the science and understand how policy is made. That allows us to do two things. First of all, they have a larger staff and they can develop some expertise in some of these areas that our very small office cannot do. And they will assist in providing some of that technical expertise and talking points and assistance from experts in each of these areas. It also allows us to very, from a tactical standpoint, join forces to deal with these issues on the Hill. So if there is a specific member of Congress, for example, who the university community feels they really need to get to on an issue, regulatory or otherwise, doesn't have to be a Tennessean, everybody focuses in on, like, what university is close to that member and that university and helps getting in the door to talk to the member and staff about that issue. So we really could not do it. I think we're very effective at our level institutionally. We're very effective with the Tennessee delegation, which has some very, very important committee assignments, including, for example, Bart Gordon, who's the chair of the House Science Committee, Lamar Alexander, who sits on appropriations and on the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Jim Cooper, who's on House Armed Services, and so forth. But we work with them, but we have to absolutely work with our national association.
Any other questions?
I have no plans to do this, nor do I know anything about it, but if there was an individual who wanted to whistleblow, is there a place in this university, is there a number that they call, is there where they don't have to be, like, called to the office?
Go ahead, Drew.
There are actually two. There's one in the medical center and one in the university. I think it's printed right on the front of this. Yeah, and these are the confidential helplines. And obviously, we like for people to whistleblow internally rather than externally, but it's their choice. So, but it's on the front here.
I tell you, what was really interesting when I was talking about the OIG investigation and the settlement we had with the Department of Justice that cost us several hundred thousand dollars. Steve Todd and I interviewed an awful lot of people in connection with our own internal review of that. Nobody that I talked to knew anything about Vanderbilt's hotlines. They all knew about NIH's hotlines, which is how NIH got contacted. But nobody knew about Vanderbilt's. And so, one of the points I made to the university's compliance office and to Jim Snell's office is that we need to do more within the university to let these numbers out there, let people know they can contact the compliance office in an anonymous way. Because we'll look to these things. We will do the right thing, but we have to know about it first.
Okay.
and we're not going to cover it up because it's certainly not in our interest to do that. And so, but, you know, so the more, if you all have ideas about how to get that out there to people, that's very important because, now, people may be afraid to call the hotlines. You know, they may feel more comfortable calling outside the university, and if they do that, then they do that. But every time we talked to somebody, we said, if you will call us, if you'll call our internal hotline, you don't have to leave your name or anything, just tell us what's going on, and we'll look into it.
Mike, could I return to the Washington scene for just a second? I want to make the point that in dealing with policymakers in Washington, our community faces a huge challenge, and that is that on the issues that are very important to us, they tend to be very complex and they tend to be very nuanced. And we're dealing with an ever-changing cast in Washington. I think the average life of a House staffer is about 2 years, about right, slightly longer in the Senate. And of course, the elected officials are subject to the voters' whims. The administration changes every few years. So we have a huge educational task to begin with. But then you look at the issues, and what we're up against is we're fighting sort of soundbite public perceptions. So no matter what the issue is, say it's high tuition costs, we probably have a fairly decent story to tell in that arena. But by the time we get down to explaining the difference between sticker price and actual cost, you know, you've lost people, they've gone on to something else. The DOD 6.1 indirect costs, that's generally seen Congress, that's just overhead. That's such your overhead rate. That's what, you know, that's just the cream you're getting. You're getting 57% on top of the deal. And you can explain these things to people, but it is complicated and you need to take the time to do it, and everybody is spread very, very thin. Another current issue is endowments and whether the feds are going to start dictating some endowment policy to us. General perception when you walk into congressional offices, you got this huge pot of billions of dollars. Just take a little money out of it, you know, and your students have to pay less for tuition. They don't understand what an endowment is, what it's meant to be, and how it's supposed to be a permanent asset for the university. So just want to leave you with that flavor, and then finally say that in telling our story, we rely in our office very heavily on faculty and administrators coming from Vanderbilt to Washington to help us tell the story. And there are people in this room who are engaged in that on a regular basis, and I hope that additional folks will be also. But you have, because of your expertise and because you're not tainted with the lobbyist perception, you have great credibility when you come into federal office. So one of the things we want to do is step up even further our engagement of you all in Washington.
And on that note, I am going to keep everybody's effort on time here and say thank you very much, Dennis, Jeff, Jerry, and John. Thank you.